Good evening. Welcome to An Evening with Alexander McCall Smith. My name is Celeste Headley. I am the host of The Takeaway, a co-production of WNYC here in New York, and PRI, Public Radio International. We are so thrilled to see so many of you out here on such a nasty evening at the end of March. I'm going to say this more than once because I want to make sure everyone really hears me, but let me start off by saying please turn off your electronics. No sound from cell phones, pagers, iPads, Blackberries, Nintendo DSs, noisy watches, whatever it is that you have. Again, I want to thank you all for coming. I want to remind you that there are copies of Alexander McCall Smith's book out in the front, and directly after the program, he will be signing more copies of them for you if you have them with you. Another thing we want to make you aware of, if you didn't see it as you were coming in, is that WNYC has two prizes available for you tonight at the end of the program. If you sign up to be part of the WNYC community, you have a chance to win an iPod Touch 64 gigabyte third generation or a flip video camera. They're all provided by TechServe, so all you have to do is sign up to be part of our community, join the family, and you could win one of those things. Mr. McCall Smith is actually going to be drawing the winners towards the end of the program, so you'll leave with your booty. And if you haven't already, like I said, be sure to buy a book. You can get it signed at the end. Again, please turn off your cell phones, turn off your pagers, turn off your iPads. And we will also have an opportunity for you to ask questions. These mics here at the front are provided there for you. I was told by his publishers to do a very brief intro of Alexander McCall Smith. But I have to do a lot of intros, and they're generally pretty dull. So when you get a bio like this one, you really kind of, you're going to have to indulge me on this, because I got to read a little bit more than just a couple sentences. Alexander McCall Smith, a Scottish writer. He was born in what was then Rhodesia and is now Zimbabwe. He's emeritus professor of medical law at the University of Edinburgh. But he's also helped to co-found the University of Botswana, where he taught law. And I wasn't able to completely confirm this, so maybe he can do this for us, but I read that he co-wrote what remains to this day the only book on Botswana's legal system, The Criminal Law of Botswana, published in 1992. It was a world-renowned expert on bioethics, medical law and bioethics. He served on any number of international committees having to deal with that subject. And of course, the reason that most of us know him is not because of bioethics, but because of his writing. It's not just that he's become world-renowned for his series, the number one ladies detective agency series set in Botswana, but he has a number of others. There's the 44 Scotland Street series. There's the Isabel Dalhousie series. And I actually have never seen a copy of one of these, but in the back of the book it says he also has the Portuguese Irregular Verb series. This is a man who writes. But it's more than just being an expert in medical law, bioethics, being an emeritus professor, helping to co-found a university and write the only textbook on an entire country's law, legal system. He's also an amateur bassoonist. He is co-founder of the Really Terrible Orchestra. And the last time I spoke to him, it was because he was opening up the number one ladies opera company in Botswana. It is an opera company and cafe for whom he wrote the libretto for the very first production, which was a version of Macbeth set among a group of baboons. And I understand they're going to be coming. They're going to be doing a production of it in Scotland, and you'll be able to purchase a CD of that soon. So, with great warmth and respect, please welcome Alexander McCall Smith. He's graciously agreed to read a couple passages from the new number one ladies detective agency series book. So please welcome.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much indeed, Celeste, for your very generous introduction. Overly generous, tremendously kind and exaggerated. So thank you very, very much indeed. At least you got most of you, well, there's quite a few things got wrong, but I'll talk to you about that later on. And thanks very much, everybody, for coming along. I remember I did an event in New York some years ago where a man came up to me afterwards and said, thanks very much for that. And I said, well, thanks for coming. And he said, I didn't mean to. And he had got his dates wrong, and he revealed that he had wanted to come to listen to somebody talking about a book which was the history of the atomic bomb. And he'd got me instead, but he was very polite about it. But there's a curious footnote to that story, which is absolutely true. You won't believe it, but it is true. I was at Mount Holyoke College. There's a graduate, and night before last, and last night, I think, yes. And I told the story about the atomic bomb incident, and this man came up to me at the end of the thing, and he said, and he had in his hand a large book, which he just turned and showed to me, and was the history of the atomic bomb, which I think is a rather spooky coincidence, and I don't know what we can conclude from that. Anyway, we're going to have a conversation later on, and then we're going to have some questions and answers, and we might get answers, and some complaints after that. So let me quickly read a couple of little excerpts from the new book, which is The Saturday Big Tent Wedding Party, which the observant reader will have noticed there's a clue in the title as to what actually happens in this book. And I don't want to spoil anybody's excitement by saying that indeed Mercuzzi does get married in this book, but you'll find that out later on. A couple of tiny little passages before our conversation. Here's Mara Matsui sitting around with Mr. J.O.B. Matacone. Now, there's quite a lot of sitting around which takes place in these books. Mara Matsui sits down and has a cup of tea, and then when I get to a point where I feel that she should sit down again, she sits down and thinks, and so on. And there's a rarely a great amount of sitting down. And the reason for this is that I have conducted extensive research, and I have discovered that these books are mostly read by people who are sitting down. And and this is called being sensitive to the identification issues with the reader. So it's very careful. There's an intent behind that. So here she's sitting down, and this is how it goes. It was a good time for sitting together, Mara Matsui felt, and it was not necessary to say anything. That evening, the sky was all but white with stars, filled with acres and acres of constellations right down to the horizon. She'd learned the names of some of these clusters when she was younger, but had forgotten most of them now, apart from the Southern Cross, which could be seen hanging over the sky towards Lebatsi, a pointer to the distant Cape and its cold waters. And the Milky Way was there too. She'd always been able to identify that, like a swirl of milk in an ocean of dark tea. As a girl, she'd imagined the Milky Way was the curtain of heaven, a notion she'd been sorry to abandon as she'd grown up. But she would not abandon a belief in heaven itself, wherever that might be, because she felt that if she gave that up, then there would be very little left. Heaven may not turn out to be the place of her imagining, she conceded, the place envisaged in the old Botswana stories, a place inhabited by gentle white cattle with sweet breath. But it would surely be something not too unlike that, at least in the way it felt, a place where late people would be given all that they had lacked on this earth, a place of love for those who had not been loved, a place where those who had nothing would find that they had everything the human heart could desire. So that's Mara Matsui thinking about heaven, and here is a little excerpt, the second quick excerpt, where she's talking to Mara Matsui. The conversations between Mara Matsui and Mara Matsui are very important, and they often talk about men. Men seem to come up in the conversation. And they're talking about how wives talk, because they've seen a mention in Clovis Anderson's Principles of Private Detection. It's a very great book, that, by the way. It doesn't exist, but I am planning I'm planning to write it at some stage. And Clovis Anderson, in fact, I can tell you that the next book, I'm planning to have Clovis Anderson visit Botswana. The real Clovis Anderson goes to Botswana, and he's a failed detective from the Midwest. And Mara Matsui, of course, thinks he's the great hero of the detective and private detective movement. And she is very kind to him, so I'm really looking forward to that. But here, Clovis Anderson had said something about what he says to his wife. His wife says he shouldn't move things because they're there for a reason, and that's what Mrs. Anderson... And Mama Coetzee and Mara Matsui think this is a wonderful glimpse into the private life of the great man. And then Mama Coetzee says, I expect she's used to it, said Mama Coetzee, and she probably talks to him like any wife, telling him to be careful and to watch what he does and so on. Mara Matsui had smiled at this. Is that how you think wives talk, Ma? She asked. If so, you should be careful when you and Futi Radafuti get married. Men don't like being told to watch what they do. But if we let them do what they wanted, then what would happen? Asked Mama Coetzee. It would be chaos, big chaos. Mara Matsui had agreed that it would not be a good idea to allow men to do as they pleased, but she felt that there were tactful ways of achieving the desired result. Rather than telling a man directly what to do, she said, a wife should make the man think that what he's doing is what he wants to do. There are ways of making this happen, Ma, tactful ways. There had then followed a certain amount of instruction on how to handle husbands, during which Mama Coetzee made the occasional note. That will be very useful for when I'm married, she told Mara Matsui, and then added, and I think you should possibly write a book, Ma. It could be called How to Handle Husbands and Keep Them Under Control, or something like that. It would be a very successful book, Ma, as there are many ladies who would rush to buy a book like that.
Well, since you pointed out that I made a bunch of errors in your intro, by the way, I have my cell phone so I can keep track of the time. I'm not looking at my email. And my third reminder, turn off your cell phones and your iPads and your... So if I made mistakes in my intro, what were they?
Well, you did say that I played the bassoon in the Rowley Terrible Orchestra. The Rowley Terrible Orchestra was correct, but I don't play the whole instrument. I just play those notes down at the bottom that I can manage. So that was a mistake. Not that I'm pedantic, but nonetheless.
And there were others. Did you really write the only book about Botswana's legal system?
No, that was a mistake as well. Actually, since you mention it, it was the only book about the criminal law of Botswana. Ah. So that was quite a glaring mistake. But I didn't want to mention that. But you brought it up.
Yeah. Well, in the name of accuracy.
It's wonderful when an interviewer starts an interview by referring to her own mistakes. That really is.
I just want to get that out of the way so it doesn't hang over us for the rest of the evening.
Unfinished business. Unfinished business.
You know, let me ask you about your main character, who's traditionally shaped. You know, she's certainly the opposite of, say, an athletic Sherlock Holmes, of the Hercule Poirot noticing every tiny detail and keeping track of people's timetables down to the minute.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, do you think that comes out of the character of the country or her own personality?
Well, that's very interesting, Celeste, and I think is probably an element of both, in that Mara Matsui is very much a child of her country, which is a very cautious country, very fine country, as I think is pretty apparent in my view of it. They are cautious people, and they're observant people, so she's got that. But there's also, I think, a considerable element of her own personality, which leads to her particular approach. She's direct, she's sincere, she doesn't believe in beating about the bush. She goes directly to issues. So contrasting her with somebody like Hercule Poirot, who's always looking for these very subtle clues, as indeed is Sherlock Holmes, is in a sense reveals how different Mara Matsui is, because she thinks that you don't have to go and look for clues. She can't really be bothered to look for clues, because she feels that if you want to know the answer to a question, you ask it. So you go and ask somebody what happened, and generally they tell you. So this is, and this makes the work of a private detective a whole lot simpler.
But it means, though, of course, that this series really couldn't take place in any other country.
Well, I think it is very particular to Botswana, and I suppose one could write something like this set in another country where one would be able to play upon a very similar local issues. It is very, very specific to Botswana. Also because Botswana is a very gentle country, and I think these books are fairly gentle, and Maramatsu is gentle. We don't have violence. In fact, we don't have any violence. Or do we have? We may actually have a little bit of violence, but it's always off stage, and there's never anything like that. We have no car chases at all in this. I did go so far as to have a chase involving supermarket shopping carts. That was a very, very bold thing on my part, because generally speaking, my readers, as you may have noticed this evening, are fairly nervous. A disposition, and we don't really want to upset them.
I think you're right. There are sometimes quick-moving cows.
Yes. Yes, that's about as exciting as it gets, actually. The cows, there's a lot of cow action.
Yeah, there is, and a lot of tea drinking.
There's a lot of tea drinking. Many people think that the tea drinking is deeply symbolic, and that when Maramatsu sits down and has a cup of tea with somebody, that the tea, which I describe at some length, has a great deal of symbolism behind it. That actually isn't strictly speaking true, because really I just put those episodes in when I can't think of anything else to. So we just sit down and have a cup of tea. And it slows the pace down, because people don't want to get too excited, so that they know that they'll have about 2 or 3 pages of tea. And then we'll go on to something a little bit more.
I just wondered if you actually had stock in, say, a Red Bush Tea Company, and making your readers thirsty for Red Bush tea, a nice cup of rooibos, actually benefited you financially.
I must think very carefully about how I answer that question. Could I write to you about that
one? Or I get a notice from your lawyer.
I'm a great fan of Red Bush tea, because it's terribly good for you. We should all be drinking it. It's very good for us. I think that if I were supporting something which was deleterious, it would be another matter. But Red Bush tea is very, very good.
That's true. Well, you know, let me ask you about your very prolificness, which is not a word, but I'm going to use it. You write a huge amount. And I'm wondering, during the time when you were a bioethicist, when you were teaching at the university, when you were writing about criminal law, were you writing these books too? Were you writing that whole time?
Yes, I always wrote in my spare time. So I'd written for decades a number of things. But I had, at that stage, really quite a small readership. I'd done collections of short stories. I'd done some collections of traditional stories. I'd written radio plays. I wrote a lot of children's books. I wrote about 30 children's books. I'd really become involved in that, really largely by accident, in that I'd entered a literary competition, which included a children's book category, and I was lucky enough to be one of the winners, and that set me off writing these children's books. So, yes, I was doing it in my spare time.
It's odd that you would think that your original character for a detective would be a doctor.
Yes, why?
Well, because that's what you spent your career teaching, law and bioethics.
Right. Yes. Well, I suppose that I might have done that. I might have written about a lawyer. There are, of course, lawyers who write about lawyers and do so very successfully and very grippingly. I think also novels about doctors or novels about medical lawyers would be rather interesting. But I prefer to write about something rather different. I do get some inspiration from some of my legal work. So in the first book, for example, in the number one ladies' detective agency book, there's a case of a baptism in a river. The reverend takes 6 sinners off to the river to immerse them. And baptize them, and only 5 come out. And he says the Lord has taken one of them. In fact, that was based on a real case which I came across. I found the court papers, and the reverend had taken the sinners off to the banks of the Limpopo River, and the crocodiles, I'm afraid, were waiting. And crocodiles don't distinguish between sinners and others, you know, so... So that was based on a real case.
Well, maybe it was before he was baptized and he was still a sinner.
Well, it was a good time to go if you aren't going to be eaten by a crocodile. You know, if you look at it in theological terms, it's quite good timing.
Yes. obviously, when you read the passage as you did about how to control your husband, which one has to assume reading that this is part of you putting yourself into a wife's position, that this is you imagining what it must be like to deal with a husband, right?
Yes, I think so. I think that's what you have to do as an author. You have to put yourself into the shoes of others. And that means if you're a male author, you must put yourself into women's shoes. And there are some authors who like that. But that's another matter. We won't go there.
Well, you are wearing a skirt.
I am wearing a skirt, yes. That helps an awful lot. This is going downhill really quite quickly.
It's funny how often my conversations do.
Yes, well, they are.
I mean, but do you then, when your story ideas come to you, is it because you're imagining what happens next to that character? Or then do you imagine a mystery and then imagine how that character deals with the situation?
Well, I tend not to have a very detailed structure or synopsis before I start writing a book. I have a general idea. Sometimes I don't even really have a general idea. Indeed, there are occasions when I have no idea at all, and I nonetheless start. I find that once I sit down to write something, then it comes, because I think that fiction is created in the subconscious mind. The human mind is always interrogating the world, is always asking what-if questions. What would happen if? We're doing that all the time, and our subconscious mind is doing it, and we aren't aware of that process of exploration and testing that the human mind is doing. As we look about something, we're classifying objects and deciding what things are all the time, all these little calculations going on. And so I think that is happening in imaginative terms in the subconscious mind as well, and the subconscious mind is thinking, what if so-and-so did something or so-and-so said something, and creating a narrative. And I think all that an author does is actually really access that developing narrative within the subconscious mind. That's where fiction must come from, and that explains why so many authors, if you ask them about this point, will actually say that the book changes, the narrative changes as they write it, in that things happen that they hadn't anticipated. And that must be because the subconscious mind is coming up with these possibilities. It's saying, oh, well, what about this being a development here? So I think that's what happens. So I tend to sit down and I go into what I suppose would be technically described as a dissociative state. Dissociative state, for the psychiatrists present in the hall, they'll know all about it. But that's where you aren't necessarily fully conscious of what you're doing, or your directing, controlling conscious mind isn't necessarily in charge of the ship. Mm-hmm. A dissociative state, hypnotism, the hypnotic state is an example of that. Or if you're driving along and you change a CD in the car, for example, something which one shouldn't technically do, but if you do that, you're probably reacting to stimuli. You're probably seeing what's coming at you along the road, but you're not fully on concentrating on that. You're concentrating on something else. And I think that's the sort of state that I go into when I write. It comes. I don't hear it in the sense of, it sounds a little bit sinister to say that one hears voices. The psychiatrist is very interested in that. You just actually, it just comes. And I hear rhythms of speech. I hear a rhythm in my head, and the words just fit that. And so I could virtually close my eyes and it would come.
So do you have a lot of discarded work or false starts where you'll start something and it doesn't go?
No, I'm very conscious of my good fortune in that I don't do that, and I don't really change it very much. In fact, the Muromatsu books are virtually unchanged. They're more or less as they come out. I do it quite quickly. It's 1,000 words a minute. I almost said a minute. An hour.
Wow. Good Lord.
No, it's 1,000 words an hour. I mean, writers have different writing speeds. Flaubert wrote 35 words a week. They were very good words, but, that was 5 words a day.
Yeah. Well, does that include the thes and the a and ands?
Yes. Wow. And if you take those out, you're left with about 22 words.
So what's the reception of these books like back in Botswana?
Well, people in Botswana have, generally speaking, been very kind and really very polite about it. I mean, obviously not everybody likes them. One wouldn't expect everybody to like what you write. So there will be some people there who I'm sure will say this doesn't reflect contemporary Botswana's problems. And indeed, they don't reflect contemporary Botswana's problems in that I don't write at any length about any of the problems which Botswana, like any other country, would have. So people might say, well, why aren't you writing about unemployment? Why aren't you writing about domestic violence? Why aren't you writing, and this is something which is frequently actually said to me, or certainly was said in the past, less so today than in the past, why am I not writing about HIV/AIDS, which of course is a very serious problem in Botswana. On that subject, actually, this book is dedicated to Professor Max Essex of the Harvard AIDS Initiative, who's done a tremendous amount for AIDS work in Botswana. The United States has done more than anybody else in helping them with the HIV/AIDS epidemic. It's something which I think people can be very proud of. But I don't put it in the books because that would just convert the books into a tragedy. I'm not writing about the difficulties of people. I'm deliberately writing about the more positive features of the country, because almost as a corrective, because so many outside writers look at sub-Saharan Africa and they address their gaze to sub-Saharan Africa and they find what's wrong and they write Heart of Darkness novels. And I didn't want to do that. So there are people in Botswana who are actually very pleased, I think, well, they tell me they are, that the books present a positive picture of an African country. And why not? You know, why should sub-Saharan Africa get this dreadfully bad press all the time and nobody really, really talk about the things that are going right? So if you take a country like Tanzania, where, generally speaking, things have gone rather well, you never read about Tanzania in the news. The focus is all on the pathological, political pathology, economic pathology, civil war, etc., all of which exists, but it's not the only side to it. So Botswana, people in Botswana have been, I think they've been, some of them have been proud that this complements them and their country, and I'm very happy to do that.
Well, I mean, since you brought up the news, then let me bring up not Tanzania, but Tunisia and some of the great waves moving across northern Africa at this point,
yes.
Which can be seen as in terms of views of Africa, what's going on there could be seen as a complete sort of revolution in the minds of the rest of the world and how they see these countries and these people.
Yes, I suppose that people are very intrigued by what is happening in North Africa, because it seems to represent a rather delayed form of what we saw happening in Eastern Europe when there was eventually people just revolted against a very firm totalitarian system, and I suppose this is what is happening in the Arab world, that a new generation which has been accustomed to participating in debates through technology, through the internet. I mean, this is to a certain extent, this is a web-based revolution in a way. It shows the power of that. And that genie can't be put back in the bottle. The young people who will say, look, we want to have greater control of our lives. I think that seems to me to be what's happening. I mean, it's more complicated than that, I'm sure, and I think there are all sorts of other currents going on there, but really I think it's a very interesting example of the power of new communications technology to have a really strong political effect.
To your point, though, as a journalist, seeing the kind of surprise that people have, how taken aback people are, I hear comments like, I didn't know they all had access to the internet, or I can't believe there's so many well-spoken people, how did they find these articulate English speakers? That, to me, as a journalist, I find that very stereotypical, but in another sense, this has been an education for the rest of the world who've kind of held the same view of the entire continent of Africa for a very long time.
Well, yes, but I mean, that even that actually directs our attention to a bit of a problem in that if people just talk about Africa as a single continent politically, then I think that really is far too sweeping, because the political culture of North Africa is pretty different from the political culture of sub-Saharan Africa. I think one really has to divide that, and there'll be, even within North Africa, there'll be all sorts of shadings and differences of opinion and views. I think that we really need to pay far more attention to some of the subtleties in countries that are perhaps just regarded as being all within a particular block. But you talk about surprise. Remember the surprise that people felt when they saw the monolithic Soviet Union crumble before their eyes. And none of us would have believed that the Soviet Union would collapse. I never for one moment thought in my lifetime that the Soviet Union would cease to be an entity, a political entity. I mean, it's absolutely... So I think really the point about politics is be prepared for surprises. Lots of surprises. And of course then one says, well, we must protect ourselves against unforeseen events. And the question then is, what unforeseen events are you talking about? What unforeseen events are you thinking of, by the way?
Well, let's go back to the books and let me ask you about an unforeseen event for the ladies in this book. And I'm going to try very hard to ask this question without giving anything away, but there's somebody running for office that they think is completely unfit.
Oh, yes, and she is. She is unfit for office. We know who they are. The readers know who you're talking about, yeah. She's a wicked woman, isn't she?
She is
bad. Really is. My goodness me.
Yeah. What was her score? I forget what score
she
got.
Oh, in the final examinations
of the... secretarial school.
Well, in the final examinations at the Botswana Secretarial College, I can tell you that Violet Sofuthu got barely 50%.
See.
Barely 50%.
Yeah.
And the reason we all know why she got barely 50% was that she was so busy chasing men. It's as simple as that. Mind you, there are those who say even if she hadn't been chasing men, she wouldn't have got much higher than 50%.
Because she's lazy.
60% tops.
Lazy.
She's lazy, yes. And she spends a lot of time doing her nails.
Yes.
And that was very, very irritating for some of the guest lecturers at the Botswana Secretarial College. They had some major figures from the secretarial world came to give lectures. And Mama Kutsi was furious because she'd be sitting there paying rapt attention to this senior figure from the sector, and there would be Violet Sofuthu painting her nails in a way which can only be described as provocative. Doubly provocative. Provocative to men, trying to provoke men in a well-known way, and in another way, provoking those good, solid girls like Mama Kutsi who were trying to do some work. It was quite shocking. I actually do get quite cross about this point.
Yeah. And they end up going through a series of different ideas on how to keep her from gaining office. And what surprised me about this was the way they discussed this, and it became a really serious topic of conversation. And they put forward ideas on things to do that were great.
Are you thinking of doing the same thing in the United States in relation to...
I'm just wondering if it would work. That's all I'm saying.
Which lady are you talking about?
Was these...
We mustn't go there.
...purely imaginative or drawn from any experience? Please tell me it was drawn from some experience.
Well, if that's what you want me to say, yes, drawn from experience.
You just dreamed it up.
I made it up.
Oh,
I mean,
dang
I must...
It.
Actually, I'm terribly sorry to tell you. I hope this doesn't come as a shock, but these books are fiction.
I know.
I'm so sorry.
It's all right. You know, as a journalist, you have to read a lot of nonfiction.
And you know Santa Claus. You know,
yeah. I know that.
You know,
I know that because
right?
I'm a mother now, and I'm the one responsible for buying the gifts.
Yeah.
There are some serious things in the book, though. I mean, in their dealings with Charlie, it's really relatively serious. And then there's another case in which she has to go and figure out what to do with a child, a young child, who's a part-time student, but also a cattle herder or counter.
That's right, yes.
And to me, these are the moments in many of the books when she's dealing with young people where you really get a sense of her own morality.
Yes.
And her patience.
Yes.
She doesn't need the answer right away. She really waits for it to come to her.
That's right. I think that's absolutely right. She's very good in handling human problems, in that she does take, as you correctly point out, she takes a slow view. She feels that things will emerge, solutions will emerge if you give them the chance, and if you speak to people in the right way, then they will emerge. She's very wise woman, Mara Mutsui, in that respect. There's great wisdom in her, and she's very gentle. She's very forgiving. Forgiveness is a very important point in the books, in Mara Mutsui's character. She believes that we should actually forgive people rather than punish them too excessively. So that's a lesson for all of us, which I suppose we all need to learn. We most of us find it difficult, but it's something Mara Mutsui actually is. She's quite good at it, actually. Mara Mutsui, to me, represents an aspirational ideal, in a sense. I think a lot of us would like to be like Mara Mutsui. And sometimes if I find myself thinking uncharitable thoughts, then I think, oh, heavens, what would Mara Mutsui think of that? So it's awful when you create somebody who acts as a sort of internal censor.
Though she does make impulsive decisions. And one of the things I've noticed in a number of the books is she's most likely to make a quick decision about is people.
Yes.
She meets the neighbor of one of the characters in here.
Yes.
And she knows within seconds that he's a good man.
Yes.
And
yes.
She can trust him.
Yes. She does that, and generally speaking, she's okay. She gets away with that, generally speaking. Sometimes she's wrong. Sometimes she's proved wrong. But generally speaking, her intuitions are good. So I think, yes, I think she does make those snap judgments. But I think that comes from a tremendous intuitive ability. And some people have that. There are people who can recognize characteristics in people quite quickly.
Are you one of them?
Not particularly, no. I mean, I can be spectacularly wrong about people, particularly builders. That's they're the real test. I think even Mara Mutsui would find it difficult to work out which builder's going to be good and which isn't. I think that's a real... I'll have to bring that up. Thanks for that point. I'll bring that up in a future novel. Builder's very difficult to read.
You know, I mean, I'm sure you get this comment all the time that how intuitive you seem to be about the female character. There's one particular incident in this book, though, that really surprised me, and I got to ask you about your research here. Because I couldn't believe how beautifully you captured the love of a woman for a beautiful shoe.
Ah, yes, 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 yes.
It was very difficult for me to believe that a man truly understands that. And yet, I have the evidence here that you do.
Yes, well, thank you for that. That actually, I quite like shoes myself, in that I think shoes are very interesting objects. In a sense, shoes are quite poignant. If you look at a pair of shoes out of which somebody has stepped, and they've left the shoes there, and look at them as objects, and they're very human objects, and they have all sorts of associations, and yet they're such passive objects. The shoes just sit there in their faithful... Gosh, this is sounding tremendously pretentious.
This is a whole monologue about shoes.
But the shoes are there, and people invest so much emotion in their shoes. They're proud of their shoes, and a person's shoes will say something about them. That's something they want to say about themselves, and that's quite poignant. If you see, you may see somebody who is perhaps fairly shabbily dressed, who may not have the money to dress very well, and maybe in threadbare clothes, but may have a well-polished pair of shoes, old faithful shoes, maybe that have been repaired. If you look at shoes that have been repaired, we, of course, just toss our shoes away in the sort of society in which we live. But go elsewhere in the world where you see cobblers, and you can see out in Botswana, they have these little workshops, people repairing shoes on the side of the street. And those shoes, a repaired pair of shoes, represents some sort of aesthetic urge that people have. I think shoes are very, very, very important. So I do write about shoes, and Mama Coetzee talks to her shoes. And they talk back. Now that is a bit of magic realism. I think it's the one bit of magic realism which I've allowed myself, in that I don't know how it started. I don't know when her shoes first started talking to her, but I really became really involved, and the shoes are now a character.
Sasses back to her.
Oh, they do. And they say, don't you forget us, boss. You go and get a new pair of shoes. What about us? The shoes actually have got attitude. And so shoes with attitude. That'd be a good advertising slogan. Shoes with attitude. So I'm very interested in shoes.
Well, you know, obviously the number one ladies detective agency is not your only series. You have your next book here in the Scotland Street series. Some fans here in the audience. This is the newest one?
That is that one. I'm just going to push it forward so I can reach this. This is the latest UK edition, which will be published in the US, I think, later this year, called The Importance of Being Seven. That's volume 6 or 7 in the series. I think it's volume 6 in the Scotland Street series. And as the title suggests, there's quite a lot about Bertie in the... Bertie's got his followers. He's a grand little boy, Bertie. You know, he really has this serious, serious problem in life, his mother. And, you know, that is a big issue, because we have in Edinburgh a very big problem with pushy mothers. You know, it's very, very serious.
It's not just in Edinburgh.
Oh, I know. I've gathered that New York has
We have a lot of Jewish moms.
Yeah. Ah, well. But you see, mothers have to be pushy. You know, we do need pushy mothers, because if we hadn't had pushy mothers, none of us would do anything. So it is very important. But some of them take it a bit far. I was talking to somebody a couple of years ago in Vancouver. West Vancouver is the epicenter of pushy motherdom in Canada.
I did not know.
Oh, virtually every mother in West Vancouver is too pushy, far too pushy. And I was talking to this man in West Vancouver, and he said, boy, have we got a problem here. And he was in a coffee shop the previous day, and he saw this person. He came, and this woman brought in her 1.5-year-old baby, a tiny child, in its stroller with its little arms hanging down in exhaustion. And and this woman said to him, you know, he gets so tired after his dance classes. So that, you know, that really... So they're pushy mothers, and poor little Bertie's pushy mother, she's made him learn Italian so that he can appreciate Italian culture. She's made him learn the saxophone. He does a very good rendition of As Time Goes By from Casablanca, which in his case it doesn't, because he's been 6 for the last 6 years. And Bertie,
that's rough. That's rough.
The observant readers have pointed this out to me, that Bertie has been 6 for 6 volumes over the last 6 years. And I take the view that I really like him the way he is. So he's that's him. He's not. And The Importance of Being 7 represents his yearning for his 7th
birthday.
So still
6. Still 6. I thought maybe he'd achieved the great birthday.
No, he hasn't, poor little boy.
Since you have it.
Yes.
And we can't get it.
Yes, just yet.
Would you read?
I will. I'll read you a little excerpt. And what it is about, this little excerpt, is it's from a chapter here. It's just a page, so it won't take long. It's from a chapter called The Comfort of Friends. And Bertie goes to a Steiner school where he has some perfectly dreadful friends. There's a horrible little girl called Olive. And Olive has said that when they're 20, Bertie's going to have to marry her. And she says she's got it in writing, and it's a contract, and that's it. And then Olive's got a horrible friend, almost as bad as she is, called Pansy. And then there's a little boy called Tofu, who's the son of two very well-known Edinburgh vegans. Although, unfortunately, his mother has recently died of starvation. And so that's the... We do get letters from vegans.
I bet
we get letters from vegans.
I would imagine.
It's really kind. They write to me.
But I bet.
Anyway, what has happened is that Irene, Bertie's mother, has a favourite charity. And her charity is an organisation that sends relief supplies to Romania. They send out-of-date medicines and out-of-date genes to Romania. And the Romanians actually want neither. But they get them. From this charity, which is called Help for Romania. And they send trucks off, loaded to the gunnels with these relief supplies, and there's a convoy of three trucks due to go off to Romania, and Irene, who supports this charity, says to Bertie, "Bertie, we will have to go and say goodbye to this convoy. They're going to have a piper playing Will You Know Come Back Again, and we must go and we'll take Ulysses." Ulysses is Bertie's little brother, who has an astonishing resemblance to the psychotherapist, Bertie's psychotherapist. But that's another point altogether. Bertie has pointed that out to his mother. He said, "Mummy, have you noticed how Ulysses' ears are very like Dr. Fairbairn's ears?" And Irene says to Bertie, "Bertie, mummies don't like that sort of comment." So they're going off, and they go off to say goodbye to the lorries, the trucks, then Bertie discovers his mother's nowhere to be seen. And he looks for her and can't find her. And he takes Ulysses back to the apartment, and they call the father, and the father comes, and indeed Irene is missing. What has actually happened, as we find later on in the book, is that Irene went into one of the trucks to inspect the out-of-date, and they closed the tailgate, and it left for Romania. And they didn't hear her banging on the side until they reached Hungary.
Probably because of the bagpipes?
The bagpipes are sounding in it, yeah. That's right, they're deafened for the first. So, anyway, Irene is missing, and the police have put notices up in the streets, "Have you seen this woman?" Pictures of Irene. And it's all very sad. But after 3 days, in the third day of his mother's disappearance, poor little Bertie has to go off to school. He has got to go back to school, although his mum is still missing. And you can imagine how sad a six-year-old boy feels if his mother has suddenly disappeared. And he's in the playground at the Steiner School, and the dreadful Olive and Pansy come up to him. And bearing in mind this is called The Comfort of Friends, and this little excerpt is what happens. "You mustn't hold tears in," said Olive. "It's better, you know, if you let yourself cry. We won't laugh at you, will we, Pansy?" Pansy shook her head. "Poor Bertie, you must feel awful. And just think, you were the last one to see her alive. That must make you feel really bad." "Yes," said Olive, "that's really bad." She paused. "I don't suppose there's any news yet, is there?" "I don't think so," said Bertie. "The police are looking for her. Maybe she just got lost." Olive looked at him with pity. "I don't think so, Bertie, do you? You don't get lost at the end of your own street, do you?" "No, I don't think she's lost." "She's probably kidnapped," suggested Pansy. Olive considered this possibility. "Maybe," she said. "People do get kidnapped, even if they don't have all that much money. Maybe they mistook her for some rich person and are holding her in a cellar somewhere." "Or an old castle," said Pansy. "Could be," said Olive, "somewhere like Tantallon Castle. You know that old castle near North Berwick? We went for a picnic there once, and I thought that it would be a really good place for kidnappers to hold people." "Do you know if the police have looked in Tantallon Castle yet, Bertie?" Bertie shook his head. "They've put notices up in Scotland Street," he said. "They have pictures of my mummy on them." Olive looked disapproving. "I don't think that's a very good idea, Bertie. That could annoy the kidnappers. They don't like people going to the police." "No, they don't," said Pansy. "That's probably made it a whole lot worse." Olive agreed. "I wonder if they've sent a ransom demand yet, Bertie. Have you had a letter yet?" "I don't think so," answered Bertie. "My dad hasn't said anything about it." Pansy remembered something. Sometimes they cut off the person's ear, Bertie. Then they put it in an envelope and send it to their house. That shows they've got the person. That's correct, said Olive. I've heard about that. That happens quite a lot in Italy, but now we're all in the European Union. They may have sent your mummy's ear already, said Pansy. Maybe your dad just thought it was junk mail and threw it away. That's quite possible, said Olive. We never open our junk mail, we just throw it away. It never crosses our mind that there could be somebody's ear in the envelope. Thank you. Oh, it's terribly sad, poor Bertie.
That is great. That is the new Scotland Street series. It's not available in the U.S. yet. Soon. Alexander McCall Smith, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.